All right. Okay, well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the final session of our fall series studying Sister Joan Chittister's book, The Time Is Now. I don't know about you, but I personally have found this to be a pretty challenging series, causing me to look at the injustices all around us in our world and how I may have been unwittingly enabling or encouraging them. And then, having done that, trying to decide what I can be doing differently to be more a part of the solution. This week, we've called on our own Pat McClure to conclude our series with her reflections on the final two chapters of our book, Tradition and Prophets Then, Prophets Now. If you've read Pat's bio in the invitation, you realize how eminently qualified she is to speak on these topics. We in the steering committee have had the privilege of working with Pat for many years and have great respect for and have greatly benefited from her prophetic vision on how this ministry of Word and Life can best educate, encourage, and support this community of thoughtful Christians in search of mature faith. So, without further ado, I'll ask Tim to put our blessing up and we'll bless Pat and send her on her way there for.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Thank you, Joe. And thank you all. It is wonderful to be on this side of the blessing. I can feel your presence. And I'm grateful for your blessing. You know, before reading this book, my sense of prophets ran pretty much along the line of, oh, John the Baptist and fire-breathing fundamentalists. But in chapter 11, entitled Voices, our author Joan Chittister reminds us that scripture calls for the prophet to seek well, not woe, for his community. In her words, she says, prophets insist that from one end of the social system to the other, we each have available that measure of life's resources that make living a blessing, not a burden. And we certainly encountered a pantheon of notable prophets seeking to help and guide their world just like this, across history that's been recounted in each chapter of The Time Is Now. In the last chapter, Joan calls these prophets then in capital letters. And we've been introduced to wise speakers and visionaries in recent history and in our own time by many of the speakers in our series. Joan calls that group of prophets, prophets now, also in capital letters. But in today's culture that's lost its bearings and quarreling about every direction that's offered, Joan's message is that everyone who has eyes to see and ears to hear what is needed for well and not woe needs to step forward to aid the situation. And that would be us, under the heading of Prophets Now, but in lowercase letters. Using her final two chapters as a guide, I'd like to set out the framework that Joan is using to shape our understanding of the big picture that we're facing today, where, in the words of Christopher Isherwood, wrong comes up to face us everywhere. And then I'd like to introduce to you two prophets now, under Prophets Now heading, who speak for a huge marginalized population that nothing has been made of until this last chapter. The framework for the last chapter is traditions, Joan writes, over time, every tradition desiccates, dries up, and becomes institutionalized. And we still live within this process as an unquestioned status quo. The marginalized population we're called to help is defined in the very last sentence of Joan's book. She writes, "Dear prophets, for the sake of the children, for the sake of the world, for the sake of the gospel, cry out." It's the children of the 21st century who are the marginalized population. And of course, we think immediately of the children in Gaza and the children of Israel, the children of the Ukraine, and of all the suffering parts of the world. But in terms of overall human development, another population of children that never reaches the front page or the op-ed columns are the children of affluent cultures, who also are being damaged by the culture itself. The developments of the 20th and 21st century society have robbed them of their most important birthright, their early years of active, imaginative play. The prophet who has spoken most cogently in the last few decades about this vital issue is Joseph Chilton Pierce, a world-famous child and human development expert. Joe, as he prefers being called, wrote 12 masterworks on human consciousness. In this Word and Life series, we've met dozens of prophets speaking brilliantly to the human condition, but I would call Joe a secular prophet. Although he's certainly fully conversant with religious traditions, Joe was an altar boy in the Episcopal Church. He was headed for seminary and then switched tracks and did his postgraduate work in religious studies at Geneva Theological College in Pennsylvania. His research and insights are firmly grounded in religious understanding. But Joe's unique contribution is that his findings and observations go hand in hand with the new scientific discoveries that were just beginning to report out when Joe started his own life journey of exploring what makes us tick. Where the vision and exhortations of prophets are enough to make us take them very seriously and think about what they say, Joe Pierce's prophetic writings carry the proof of the pudding in them as well. With his own gifted mind, Joe drew together emerging discoveries in typically unrelated and unconnected scientific fields. He would draw them into relationships of stunning new meanings regarding the development of human intelligence, and then placing these proofs in the service of the human spirituality that they're all meant to serve. It was his second book that came out in the late 70s that catapulted him to fame, The Magical Child, many of you have read it, whose pages profoundly question the current thinking about childbirth practices, about parenting, about educating our children. Those facts and ideas are still prophetically accurate today. From the instant of birth, Joe says, the human child has only one concern: to learn all there is to learn about the world around him. The primary way to accomplish that drive is to play. Open, physical, imaginative play from toddlerhood on to hopefully at least age 9. Other famous voices have urged the necessity of play for children. Maria Montessori based her entire philosophy of early childhood education on the idea that play is the work of the child. Fred Rogers said that play is often talked about as if it were a relief from serious learning, but for children, play is serious learning. Play is really the work of childhood. Joe touched the heart of it all when he wrote, All children want to do is play in worlds that they create and project on their external world. If they're allowed to do that, they are constantly building new neural structures for creating reality. And they build up an enormous self-esteem and a feeling of power over the external world with their own playing capacities. Most importantly, in play, children learn how to learn. In an interview a few years ago, Joe explained that in the first 3 years of life, the absorbent mind of the child has either opened up to embrace a benevolent universe or closed down into a frightened defense mechanism on guard against a world it can't trust, which is the root cause of much of our social mess today. The status quo is our urbanized lifestyles. Parentless children for much of the day with both parents working. Highly organized daycare. Hours of babysitting videos. Our tiger mom expectations that our kids should read by kindergarten. Well, you get the drift. But what most of us don't fully understand is the cost in the quality of human consciousness and capacity that results from eliminating this original natural play that evolves our children. We're watching the foreclosure of the capacity for stable emotional lives, for lives that are creative, and for the development of human spirituality. In each of his books, Joe repeatedly refers to one singular figure who he believes is the model of human wholeness, of the ultimate potential for human being. That person is Jesus of Nazareth, whose great presence is understood by Joe Pierce not primarily as a theological model, though he certainly gets that, but as a model of actual biological function that humanity has been designed to achieve, if we'll only encourage it. The core of Jesus's extraordinary human functionality is what Pierce calls unconflicted behavior. A life that is lived with no interior conflict whatsoever, in continuing connection with all that is. Mystics call it oneness. Joe sees it as a flow of endless opportunity that's seen as entirely positive, for arrangements that are never wrong for very long, and in which there is no failure, but constant opportunities for workarounds, as we'd call it in our families, also called forgiveness. It sounds a lot like a happy childhood. Contemplating Joe's notion of unconflicted behavior helps me make sense of that passage in Matthew, in which Jesus said, "Suffer the little children, and forbid them not, to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven." If the child-sized version of Jesus' kingdom of heaven is unconflicted, imaginative play rumbling across the neighborhood, one wants to speculate what that state in an unconflicted adult life might be. What we do know is that one life lived in true, open, interconnected, unconflicted wholeness was enough to change the course of human history and destiny. The Magical Child and The Bond of Power and all his subsequent books unfold Joe's research, revealing that the evolutionary structure of our brain and its dynamic interactions with our heart are designed by nature to reach well beyond our current capacities as we're living them out today. We're designed to literally transcend. And the underpinnings of this ascent are found in the state of play that is encoded in every child's body, ready to unfold into action if the environment supports it. That environment consists of children feeling unconditionally wanted, loved, and accepted. About 25 years ago, Dr. Alan Shore published research that might never have made it to the front page if Joe Pierce hadn't drawn its implications together to give us a picture of how the mother's emotional state selects the brain power that her progeny will have while she's still pregnant. Brain scans and lab work with mothers at various stages in their pregnancies told a compelling story. When the environment around the pregnant mother is tense and uncertain, and her emotional state stressed and anxious, Mother Nature reads those signals and directs more development to the old hindbrain, consistently on the alert and ready to fight or flight. Her baby is born with increased capacities for defensive living. When the environment around the pregnant mother is secure and positive, in a state of happy anticipation, Mother Nature reads the signals and directs more development to the forebrain with its capacities for positive and creative living. The implications of womb life here are enormous. But Prophet Joe draws us into a wider spectrum of understanding when he urges us to think of the next stage of the child's development after birth taking place in another kind of womb that's made up of the arms of the parent, of the watchfulness of grandparents and caretakers, and in the physical environment that the young child is mastering day by day. If this circle of care fully accepts and delights in the child, that heart-open deep learning play continues without limit, and it lays down a foundation for a lifetime of creative learning. School, of course, is another metaphoric womb environment for 6 hours a day. If children don't feel safe and secure in their learning environment, their deep personal learning switches into a kind of conditioning, rote learning of outside knowledge that doesn't come home to roost personally for them. In the last two decades of Joe's work, his prophetic mind was increasingly focused on the dangers of another kind of metaphoric womb that has emerged on the scene, the digital world that interacts with our children's brains, directly affecting their neurology. I remember reading with alarm in the 1990s Joe's discussion of what happens to babies' brains when they are exposed to the radiant light of a television screen. In the 1950s, TV screens display the first flickering radiant light images, and the interested watchers instantly dropped into a comatose state. They were hypnotized. Well, to keep them awake so that they could pay attention to the ads that were running that young industry, technicians added the startle effect, a rapid change in light intensity and sound and erratic camera angles that immediately activated the body's stress response, pulling the defenses of the hindbrain online and releasing two hormones, adrenaline and cortisone, to produce a continuous low-level stress experience no matter what the content of the show, and lasting long after the TV was turned off. Unhealthy for adult minds who are experienced enough with that kind of display, but deadly for young brains whose evolving neurology turns away from its healthy creative development to stocking up an anxious, defensive life response. 70 years of astounding development have brought the information revolution full swing today, with all its toxic and crippling effects for brain and behavior. Here's how I see it being handled when I go up for playtime here in Tucson at my granddaughter's house. I go up once a week, take full advantage of the chance to play with these great-granddaughters. My great-granddaughter Lydia, an adorable six-month-old, has a screen placed between her play quilt or bouncy chair and the TV screen when it's on for precisely 45 minutes to an hour at lunchtime when toddler sister Ruthie is allowed that brief time of video watching to quiet her down and get ready for reading and nap time that's coming. Lydia merely hears the drone of the sound while Ruthie watches the flickering screen in a quiet, hypnotized state that is occasionally broken in by great-grandmother's or mom's comments about the action on the screen. It temporarily breaks the trance and encourages a little bit of meaning to emerge, and then the cortisol drip continues. But in most houses in our over-busy world, parents let their children from toddlerhood on use cell phones to calm them down so that their exhausted parents can get their own duties done. Behind that scene of today's family life, the tech industry is investing millions of dollars in research that's led by experts in behavioral addiction, all of it to attract us to our screen devices. The chief strategy here activates neural networks. Dopamine pathways are activated in the brain, a common feature in both behavioral and chemical addictions. A stress response is triggered that's both addictive and destructive to neurological and behavioral functioning. The blue light that's emitted from the screen devices disrupts the natural cycle of melatonin production. It disrupts sleep, and it leaves children wired and tired. Now, if her book were being written today, Joan would doubtless have included the story of a whole village of parent prophets who have made headlines over the last 4 months as they dealt with the effects of the toxic screens of smartphones. The grandparents and the parents in the town of Greystones in Ireland watched their school children experiencing increasing addiction, anxiety, and exposure to adult content as they use their smartphones. The push to ban those smartphones came after two young girls in the area committed suicide as a result of online bullying. In an impressive show of solidarity, parents and the schools of Greystone implemented a voluntary no smartphone rule. And 4 months later, the results are already showing less anxiety, more self-responsibility, and more effective learning. Now, these are Joan's people, prophets in lowercase letters, who are calling out a serious problem for their children and stepping up to do something about it. Just as important as his findings about play, Joe Pierce's writings about the intelligence of the heart give us a signpost to the next step of human development. Using our full complement of intelligence by consciously engaging our heart's knowing with our brain's knowing. Now, happily, you all know about these findings. We spent an entire fall, a few seasons ago, exploring the mind and the heart with the folks from the HeartMath Institute. But for those who may not have been there, let me describe the territory to which the signpost is pointing. In terms of children and the state of play that we're all born to take part in, children are still connected to the higher frequencies of their natural heart's intelligence while they're still in early childhood. They naturally operate with head brain and heart brain working in tandem in their daily consciousness. When they're safe and cared for, kids live out the innate tendencies of that frequency of heart brain intelligence, such as uncomplicated love, lack of prejudice, transparency, and especially their superpower to release and forgive and move on. When they're in this kind of open, imaginative state, kids just soak up learning. This natural heart coherence is the basis of the play state. Children's minds are not yet entrained to the countless lower vibrations of society's mindsets and habits. The last time I saw Joe teaching in yet another workshop, he urged us to check out the life and work of Fred Donaldson, who was a master of the state of play. Well, I was in need of some useful teaching about children's play at that point, so I looked up Fred on the internet, and I was very impressed with what I found. So impressed that I clicked on his calendar for the current year's teaching schedule and discovered that by some synchronicity and the grace of God, Fred was going to be in Ojai in 2 weeks. Now, Ojai is just a little town 45 minutes away from Santa Barbara. So I managed to shoehorn my way in, and I went up to the Krishnamurti School in Ojai, spent the weekend with Fred Donaldson's teaching, and came away with a whole new grasp of what's possible for kids and their elders. The backstory here is that I was on the board of my church's preschool as we wrestled with an increasingly fraught tug of war with some very vocal parents who wanted their children to be able to read before they went to kindergarten. Now, the teachers of this school insisted on the Montessori philosophy that play is the work of the child. And they had developed a wonderful, safe, and very caring space where kids raced in every day, played and learned in the unbroken pattern of natural development and connection to everything around them. As the parent crisis escalated, and while Fred was still on the West Coast, I got in touch with him to see if he could come and give us some instruction about children and play. The answer was that he had one Friday evening open, and it was in the coming month, and he'd be glad to spend it in Santa Barbara. So some 50 parents and teachers trooped into the parish hall to hear him speak. Well, it was a compelling evening, as you might imagine. He pointed out many of the things that I've been reporting, and he talked a lot about the reality of an unbroken continuum of natural, active intelligence that exists not only in our kids, but in every form of life, and invisibly in the spaces between things. Frequencies of being that children can still perceive. Well, I found myself remembering a quote from Gregory Bateson that had become famous. What is the pattern that connects the crab to the lobster and the primrose to the orchid and all of them to me and me to you? In order to illustrate this pattern of safe, unbroken intelligence of life, that is still a part of our children's existence when they're in the play state, Fred told this story. He'd been invited to India, I think it was Mumbai, for a week-long schedule of workshops there in the schools. One of his host families lived outside the city, backed up against the big forest there. The youngest child of the family, a six-year-old daughter, had become Fred's best pal. And on his last morning with the family, he hoped to play a bit with the daughter before he left. But he noticed that she just wasn't around. "Oh, she'll be back soon," said her mother. "She's been disappearing around breakfast time for the last few days to play with some friend. I didn't get the name yet." "Well," said Fred, "let's go see if we can find them and maybe watch a bit of their play." So he and the mother walked into the forest, listening for sounds of the children's play. As they got into the dense part of the trees, they heard her crooning a little song. Fred was first on the path. He came around a tree, and he saw the play screen, and quickly turned around, and in a kindly way, put one hand over the mother's mouth and the other arm around her waist so that she would emit no sound when she, too, saw who her daughter was playing with. The little girl was seated on her knees, holding out a saucer of honeyed milk to a king cobra, who coiled opposite her and in rhythm with her song, swayed forward to dip his forked tongue in the milk, and then swayed back again. They watched the dance, and Fred very quietly turned the mother around, and they crept soundlessly out of the jungle, back to the house. A few minutes later, the girl came bouncing back and was met with a careful conversation and a gentle but firm stop to meeting and playing with friend Cobra. But her mother was left marveling over the pattern that connects, in which child and environment can operate in safety as long as the child is in that original play state that had been so clearly visible in the clearing in the forest. The infant plays in the womb. The play of energies back and forth is not only the pattern of intelligence between mother and child, but between each of us and life itself. As adults, we're designed to play with life as much as our children are. It opens us to see life differently. Earlier this week, I had a visit from one of my dearest friends. And in the course of our many conversations, I found an unexpected confirmation of my message this morning. She's a widow of several years, and after a lifetime of living with and for her family and close friends and neighborhood, she finds herself now living alone in a condo and is isolated from her old neighborhood and life. Still, I found her brimming over with interest and alertness and asked her what the secret to her enthusiasm was. Well, she answered, I seem to be learning all over again how to play with life. I learned that daily chores don't bog her down because she plays games with the process or makes stories out of her routines just for herself. She's in a serious relationship with her plants and with the trees along her walk. She talks to them and she listens. She's given up cooking for the gang, but she is trying her hand at poetry. Eric Erickson said, while the playing child advances forward to new stages of mastery, the playing adult steps sideward into a new reality. Picasso observed, it takes a very long time to become young. But we might say in response, just look at the state of the world. So many terrible things are happening. We can't just be playing around with it. The answer from the laboratories and fieldwork of the HeartMath Institute would say the opposite. In fact, this is just where the rubber hits the road. When we can train our own biological systems to calm down, come into inner heart-brain balance, and dwell in a sense of appreciation, we literally emit frequencies of intelligence, sending out harmonious signals that are powerful and have the possibility to pull up some of the choppy static of our social atmosphere into order. And at the same time, when we're able to move into that state of inner coherence, the pattern that connects becomes more visible to us, and it pulls us into its timely order and harmony. When you think about the difficulties of attempting these notions of deep play and unconflicted behavior in today's world, let me tell you the story of the thinking heart of the barracks. This was a sign that was tacked on the tattered bunk belonging to Eddie Hillesum in Westerbork, a concentration camp in Holland in 1943. Here are the words of the publisher of her diaries that somehow made their way intact back to Eddie's friends after the war. Eddie was a mature, nonconformist Dutch woman attempting to grapple with the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust by changing the workings of her internal mind, and in doing so, developed a mystical relationship with the presence of God, not only within her, but connecting to the ongoing pattern of the larger life of nature around her. In the concentration camp of Westerbork, she had unusual experiences of spiritual awakenings and insight. She wrote, "These 2 months behind barbed wire have been the two richest and most intense months of my life, in which my highest values were deeply confirmed. I have learned to love Westerbork. Her time at Westerbork, as reflected in her diaries, portrays the redemption of her spirit while her body was captured and murdered. She neither denies the horror of the Nazi terror nor identifies with her victimhood. In the midst of extreme conditions, Hillesum develops an awareness of the indestructible beauty of the world. She writes during her time at Westerbork, "The sky is full of birds. The purple lupins stand up so regally and peacefully. Two little old women have sat down for a chat. The sun is shining on my face. And right before our eyes, mass murder. The whole thing is simply beyond comprehension." Everywhere, things are both very good and very bad at the same time. The two are in balance, everywhere and always. I never have the feeling that I've got to make the best of things. Everything is fine, just as it is. Every situation, however miserable, is complete in itself, and it contains good as well as bad. On the 7th of September in 1943, less than 3 months before her murder, she threw a postcard with her final words out of the train. "Opening the Bible at random, I find this: the Lord is my high tower. I am sitting on my rucksack in the middle of a full freight car. Father, mother, and Misha are a few cars away. In the end, the departure came without warning. We left the camp singing. Thank you for all your kindness and care." Well, I see Eddie as another of Joan's prophets who stepped up, spoke out, and helped to heal her fellow sufferers and found the presence of God and the pattern that connects in the midst of a world gone mad. She is proof of John 4:18. There is no fear where love exists. Fred Donaldson sums up the access points to this state of mind for more ordinary lives and circumstances like ours. He writes, "We must leave despair behind, humble our sense of selfhood, incorporate time to feel and play with objects, ideas, each other, and look at the world with the transformative imagination of children to see past our self-inflicted limitations." Remember Einstein's famous admonition, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." What Joe and Fred bring to us is the key to finding the new mode of consciousness that Einstein calls for. And it's not just ideas, but wired in biological functions of intelligence waiting to be used. If we can master the shift into a mode of heart coherence and as much playful, unconflicted behavior as we can bring to the moment, we will contribute significantly to a healthier reality. Teilhard de Chardin wrote, "Each act of love, no matter how small or hidden, moves all of reality closer to unity and connection." A much younger soul, Anne Frank, wrote, "How wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world." Now, all of this sounds like the territory that we grandparents are patrolling. We can be the lowercase prophets that Joan's calling for in our own families, our own churches and communities, for our homeless. Advocating for open, clear play spaces and times for the children in our own neighborhoods, in our own county. We can get down on the floor and play with toddlers we can engage in imaginative forays with our middle childhood friends and our grandchildren. And we can read aloud, an activity that is much in the news again in the rather belated discovery in some laboratories that the spoken word triggers image and meaning making in the forebrain that can never happen in video watching. It's what I've been doing all morning here. And indeed, it turns out that reading aloud is not only a gift for our children, but one that can be turned around for our own mature uses, just like play. It secures a more pliable and creative brain in our own aging heads. Statistically, reading aloud is a help in slowing down Alzheimer's disease. The title of a book that I have just read about it is called The Enchanted Hour, The Miraculous Power of Reading Aloud in the Age of Distraction by Megan Cox Gurdon. So whether we have children near us or not, we can reclaim the deep spirit of play in whatever portion of our lives that we're willing to open to it. The glint of childhood's curiosity and eagerness is still within us. Jesus said, "Suffer the little children and forbid them not to come unto me, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Joe believed that play is the only way the highest intelligence of humankind can unfold. So perhaps we can answer Joan's call and put some of this to work in our own lives. Goethe wrote, "Whatever you can do, or dream you can, begin it now." Boldness has genius, power, magic in it. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Pat. I'm going to put the questions in the chat if you'd like to read them for everyone.
Yes.
And invite us into conversation.
When or where in your life have you experienced the pattern that connects? Question one. When or where in your life have you experienced the pattern that connects? Question number two. Thinking about your own situation, how might you shift into lighthearted, playful attitudes that encourage things to play out in fresh ways? How can we shift into that lightheartedness that allows things to play out in fresh ways? Those are the two questions. Thanks, Tim.
Very welcome. Well, I'm looking forward to a good 20 minutes together here of some reflection group dialogue and hope that you have a wonderful conversation. Just a reminder, we'll be back with Pat at around 11:10 for some closing conversation as well. So remember to accept the little pop-up. And if you're in a group smaller than three, I will move you to a bigger one. So have a great time in your reflection groups, and we look forward to seeing you back soon. All right, everyone, welcome back. The time is now for some good conversation with Pat. So if you have any questions, as usual, you can raise a hand like this. You can raise it digitally. You can type something in the chat. But looking forward to having some closing time together here. Pat, I don't know if you have any opening remarks you'd like to offer up. You can unmute if so. If not, we'll jump into questions.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I probably will have some remarks to make in terms of where I see your own comments and questions going. So what happened in your own groups? What little insight popped up for you this morning? A question or a comment? I'd love to hear. In our own group, we found ourselves moving around to a lot of sort of unexpected ideas about how play reforms itself in adult life. And one of the most frequently experienced ways that I think that happens for us is with our animals, which, of course, I did not mention. But think about your own animals. Think about the play. Animals naturally play. They eat, they play, they may fight, but not very much, especially domesticated animals. Mostly they live in the play state. So think about your own animals. Any comments about music, animals? These are all adult play states. Yes, Marianne.
And of course, here I am with my animal. but in our group, we talked about what happens in our adult state, what we call play, often is beyond play and becomes competitive. So we call play, which really, I mean, how many of us with sports and, you know, so many facets of play are actually competitive and split us into right, wrong, good, bad, lose, win. And the question arose, and we didn't have really time to digest it. How do we stay present to that state of play in the midst of this competitive world that we live in?
Well, I don't have it at hand, but Fred Donaldson, the master of play whom I referred to, has written two remarkable books about play and adult play. And more than remarkable, he's a philosopher and a prophet and enormously wise. And he says that our culture teaches us to play a particular game that he calls the Duchess game. And it is a game that's nothing but contest. And you're exactly right, Marianne. He explains that very early, we're indoctrinated into contest playing. I think about the Little League experience that my kids and grandchildren all went through. And then I think about the sandlot and middle of an old street kind of baseball that I played when I was a kid. The difference is profound. Yet that's been foreclosed by well-meaning parents who want to teach their children this other kind of play. So, Marianne, I would say that I have learned to put a little adjective in front of the kind of play we are talking about. It's original play. It's the play that animals engage in. It's the play that little kids engage in. And it is a huge container, of course, for the play of, you know, Leonard Bernstein, of Pablo Picasso, of especially Einstein, who played a lot. So that's the difference.
His book, by the way, is called Playing by Heart.
Playing by heart, exactly. Mm-hmm. You may all have had a little jolt when I explained that Joe Pierce, with all of his good religious training and behind him, nevertheless thinks of Jesus of Nazareth as a biological phenomenon, as well as a theological one, because that same biology is in us. That biology that is unconflicted, which is what Marianne is referring to. If we're unconflicted, no contest, life is just flowing through us and it can become anything. Yeah. So other questions, comments? Music? Anyone? Where does that rest with you?
You're reminding me, Pat, we were speaking last night in our community conversation about what practices or relationships sort of help us to reorient to beauty and reorient, sort of come home to ourselves. And for me, music was definitely one of those, you know? And so I definitely know that to get in that sort of flow state of play, and it's kind of coincidental, they call it playing music, you know, but is definitely one for me. So thanks for reminding me.
Yes, Michael.
Well, my sister raised her hand. So Hey, sis, you want to talk?
Well, I was just going to bring up music. That's funny because we discussed in our group, none of us were musically talented, but we talked about music and art, anything that brings about laughter. We talked about nature, being out in nature. We talked about being around children and pets. But the other thing that we weren't quite clear on, and I wonder if you can give us just a little synopsis again on the pattern that connects.
Yes. One of the books that Joe Pierce encouraged us to read years ago is a book by a woman named Jean Liedloff. She's a woman who found her way up the Amazon in the company of some documentarians sociologically who were looking for a particular tribe that they'd heard about that never connected to 20th century life, that was deliberately and carefully kept secreted so that their way of life wasn't poisoned by any connections to 20th century. They were known by this group of filmmakers and under very stringent circumstances allowed them to come in and make a film of the way life was run in really prehistoric days. I think the name of these people were the Kogi. And the young woman who I'm speaking of, Jean Liedloff, was of such an open, natural nature that she was accepted by her by these rather small tribesmen and invited to stay for a few months after the filming crew left. And she had a chance to watch this prehistoric way of life unfold. She said that she had never seen anything as harmonious, as joyful, as smart, and efficient a use of all their resources. She said that she finally began to understand that they lived in a kind of unbroken connection with the life around them, that they knew, you know, we talk about talking to trees and trees talking back to us. Well, children can do that, and a few adults can. But this troop actually, this tribe, some of its members were in natural communication with trees and notified when a particularly rich flow of sap, which they needed for one particular purpose, was about to come and which trees to go to. They understood that within the next two or three days, a deluge was going to happen, which none of her instruments for weather reporting made clear to Jean. They lived within an unbroken continuum of intelligence, talking to each aspect to the other of this Kogi tribe. Australian Aborigines have the same thing, just barely still present in their lives. It's called dream time. And they move into this other state, this deep play state, stand in what looks like a yoga stance with one foot on the knee of the opposite leg, just in that strong sort of tree or stork. I think I remember it as the stork when I was doing yoga years ago. And they move into a deep consciousness with the intelligence, the broadcasting intelligence of the earth itself. If they are in need of game, that is the question they take with them into this dream state. When they come out of the dream state, they don't say anything. They simply start to run, and the rest of the tribe follows them because they are on their way to where game is and exactly where it is. If they need rain, they come back out of the state and they begin to run toward that area that is going to get rain the next that afternoon at 4 p.m. It's an amazing way of living in a world that speaks back to us. That's that unbroken pattern that connects. I don't know, Ellen, if when you were a little kid, you could kind of see little extra lights or something funny that your parents couldn't see. Can any of you remember that as children? Yes, lots of heads nodding. Well, that wasn't make-believe. That was probably some form of this wonderful, living, intelligent universe that we've been given with the planet. Does that help at all, Ellen? Does that make it at all clearer? Other questions, comments? How do we do this today in our own lives? And of course, we've all got potted plants. We can begin there. Many of us have animals. We can begin there. In this crowd, all of you move into prayer. And some of you may be able to move from time to time into that larger sense when you're connected to something more than just yourself. Anybody ever experienced that? Oh, yes. Heads nodding all over. That, my friends, is part and parcel of this playtime. Play, in this sense, is original. God talking to us, talking to God experience. That's what that original play means. It's a lot like, as one of you said, making music, playing an instrument. That's what play does, play is.
Diana, I saw a hand there.
I'm thinking about meditation when you're talking about these things. How does that come in?
Meditation moves us into that zone of quietness. And it can, and hopefully will, open up that heart space so that we can begin to intuit what is around us. Intuiting is very different from the mental notion of understanding so that we can describe back. Intuiting is a whole body response, which is very much what's involved with meditation. Otherwise, you'd be able to meditate while you're roller skating. Well, actually, you may go into meditating if you're roller skating. My surfer friends, I know for sure, move into that state when they're surfing. But whether it's quiet or on the foot, it involves the entire body, doesn't it, Diane?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it involves breath. It involves feeling. So that is play at its quietest, at its most open. Yes. Wonderful. Thanks for that. Any last comments or questions you'd like to ask? Yes, Joe, Pat.
I got it. Okay. I thought one thing that came up in our group that I think is rich for all of us is with being overwhelmed with so many things happening in our world right now. Not that it doesn't always happen, but especially now, I think we're praying and concerned about people in so many different locales, that the opportunity to play is probably better for our psyche and more important for our psyche now, not in ignorance of what is surrounding us in our world, but rather to allow us to better focus and for our own health, be able to move forward, and it probably prepares us better to be more of the prophet of where we want, where we feel so deeply about. But without taking care of ourselves and with humor, with laughter, with looking at birds, whatever is big for you, games, what have you, non-competitive, Marianne, but really just really giving us the opportunity to realize that we have to create our own balance. And thanks, Pat, for bringing that up, because as you know, I worked so many years with young children. And that is of crucial importance and beauty, absolute beauty, to watch children truly play.
It is. One of the books that we read maybe 3 years ago was Parker Palmer's Healing the Heart of Democracy. Mm-hmm. He is a Quaker, of course, and I've had a chance to be in some of his groups and certainly followed his work for several years. use a lot of it in my own teaching. And what I've learned is that when we can settle into a circle of trust where we are fully accepting of each other and interested in the people in our circle, we set up a lot of those same conditions that I was able to speak of earlier that exists in that next womb after the child comes out of the womb, hopefully having been so loved that the forebrain is bristling with more neurons than the hindbrain. But in that early childhood circle of trust, that's when a lifetime of brilliance really gets settled in. That's what happens with grownups in these Quaker circles of trust when we really do trust each other. Or there's always humor that circles in those groups. And very easily, they are able to find one or two things that they can agree on. That kind of agreement is called harmony in music, but it's called common ground in politics. It's the same thing. And looking for that common ground is much easier when we have a modicum of trust in each other. When we're able to relax a little bit with each other, we can see more clearly those possibilities of agreement, those possibilities of harmony. So politics and play absolutely meet in the work of, say, someone like Parker Palmer. And when we're dealing with people who have opposing viewpoints, I believe that when we can, you know, relax and enjoy each other, we are much more likely to come to a place of common ground. That gives us the place where we can take our next step and make some political hay out of it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Pat, we just have a couple of minutes left. Wondering if you have any final offerings for us before we close.
Oh, thank you, Tim. Well, in the process of preparing for this, I came across a little poem written by a woman named Jenny Justice. I thought I would read it aloud as a way of thanking you and closing out this notion about original play, godly play. She writes, "We forget what it's like to simply exist in moments of joy. The one thing that separates adults from kids is not age, not time, not wisdom, not responsibilities, bills, work, or things that we label as adult that are just bad habits dressed up as something that we've earned a right to, like drink, gamble, use people, use each other, be snide, be snarky, suppress feelings. No. What makes an adult is the inability to play without fear, to play without restraint, to play without feeling foolish. We forget. And we mourn a bit, sure, because of the bills, because of the work, because we confuse things like bars and drinking or parties or thrills for play, when these things are not play. Play is an endeavor of the spirit. Playfulness is an attitude of pure glee. Playing is curiosity in action, discovery, pretending. Play is approaching each moment as new, full of beautiful possibility, of imagination. Play is grace and laughter, even when falling and crawling. Play is using our bodies, our hearts, our minds and spirits to explore the world around us with kindness and awe. We forget this. We have to remember. We have to make time, all of us, children, adults, men, women. We have to remember to play. Thank you. See you next January.
Thank you, Pat. Joe, I don't know if you have any final words, or Judith, whoever would like to ring us out.
Just,
just again, thank you, Pat. And I think, you know, for a lot of us, we downplay the importance of play in our lives, right? Because how can you be playful when there's so much garbage going on and so much, there's so much drama and stuff going on in the world. But, you know, I think what I take away from this is that maybe we have to become more childlike, and instead of being feeling stymied or frozen or overwhelmed by what's going on, as Pat Wheatley was saying, maybe we need to be a little reckless and you know, dream about what could be and look for ways to make things happen. And that, you know, one of the things I've gotten from this series is that there are little things, little positive things that we can do to make our world a little better place. And that, as Pat says, that radiates out, and what we do in our little world radiates out into the big world. So again, thank you. Judith, that's.
Well, thanks you so much, Pat. And while you were talking, I'm thinking about pickleball, and pickleball is play. But we have our little group, we have a way of, it's not competitive. It is, we have two rules. It's to have fun and stay upright. And it's really not a competitive group. It's just a wonderful, we encourage each other. Oh, that was a wonderful shot. Oh, how'd you do that? So I just am delighted to get out there every Monday and Wednesday at noon. And Peggy Cellino is there. Diana is, she is with us. And Marianne is there, so they know what we're talking about. So there are different ways to play pickleball. You can, you know, really smash it and be competitive, or there's our way. So thanks everybody for coming, and we really appreciate your attendance and your support. And we are meeting, we're still meeting to decide on what we're going to do in the winter, but stay tuned. We will be back with you about what we're all about in the winter time. Thank you. And let's go off and play. All right. Unmute and thank Pat. Thank Pat for.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you all. Thank you.
Take care,
everyone.
We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Thanks.
Happy Thanksgiving. We'll see you.
You too.
Happy Christmas, and we'll see you next year.
See you soon.